Welcome to Life Skills for Kids, Superstar Practical Strategies, your go-to podcast for surviving and thriving with your children. I'm your host, Deb Hopper, and as a parent and an occupational therapist, I understand the reality of getting through each day with the kids. Join me as we delve into tips, tricks, and strategies that you can use today. Hi, and welcome to the Life Skills for Kids podcast. I'm your host, Deb Hopper, and today we are talking about anxiety in kids. And you will probably, if you've listened to this podcast before, probably know this is a passion of mine. And today we are having a friendly family discussion with my cousin, Lisa Pratt, and her son, Andrew Pratt. And Andrew has been on this podcast before, so welcome both of you.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you guys. So as we talk about anxiety, often anxiety can run in families, and I guess it has run in ours. And I'm just wondering, Lisa, when you had a young family, how did you realise, or when did you realise that anxiety was playing a part in the family dynamics?
Andrew was probably in grade one. No, he would have been mid-grade two. And I'd get periodic phone calls from school saying that Andrew was having a panic attack and could I come and get him? And I'd say, right, put Andrew on the phone and we'd have a chat. And I would go along the lines of, you know, him, I want to come home. And I'd say, what's wrong? He'd say, nothing. And I'd talk about how he was feeling. And then I'd say, okay, so there's nothing really wrong. No, that's okay. Well, now back to class. And he'd go back to class.
Mm-hmm. And how did that feel for you, Andrew, to be sent back to class?
Well, yeah, as Mum said, it was definitely a panic attack. And looking back now, it actually became a fairly regular thing. I think we spoke about it, you and I, on the first time I was on here, very briefly. But panic attacks were regular, and Mum speaking me through them was a way to go. I don't think schools back then were equipped or understood how to deal with kids having a panic attack, because it wasn't really something that was being discussed. Mm-hmm. Kids having anxiety, it was, doesn't seem that long ago for most people, but even in like 2004, 2005, schools weren't equipped to deal with anxiety. So Mum saying, giving me a strategy to breathe through it and to move on and then go back to class was probably the best thing for me. And I think it only happened, I don't know, maybe what, four or five times, Mum? But
4 or 5 times maximum. And in hindsight, I actually don't think high schools were equipped to cope with panic attacks until maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I know that it wasn't till Madison, Andrew's sister and my daughter, was probably in year 9 that her high school was actually able to cope with her panic attacks.
Yeah.
Wow, that's quite recent, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredibly recent. In my 14 years at my one school, I'd say that it's realistically only in the last 5 years that we've got good strategies for coping with anxiety at school.
Yeah, so it was on me to cope and to have a strategy to deal with it and move on. And I did have some really good teachers once I got into year 3 and year 4 and year 5 that were the sort of people that knew how to deal with it naturally because they had kids or they were a personality and a person who understood it. But up until then was, yeah, kind of on me to, if I had spoken to Mum, to go back to class or to manage it in class and then move on with my day.
And thinking about it, when the deputy spoke to me on the phone and said, we've got your son here and he's having a meltdown, the word anxiety actually wasn't used. It was just, oh, he's having a meltdown. Mm. And they actually sounded bemused and they were really perplexed about what was going on. Mm. And they were talking to me as the parent saying, oh, we've not seen this before. What's happening? And I just remember, you know, calmly talking to Andrew. No, he was just overwhelmed. And so, yeah, it was definitely giving him a strategy. And some kids you may not want to send back to class, but with both ours, it was right. It's time out. We've got to deal with the real world. So we need strategies that are going to go with you for the rest of your life. So that was in the back of my mind.
What strategies did you talk through with them on the phone?
It was about identifying what was the real issue. So what is actually causing you to panic? Is it something big? Is it something little? Something the teacher you've done? And I think most of the time it was probably social and Andrew reacting to other people in the room, maybe the teacher, but certainly students, and then him not knowing how to cope with the social aspect.
Hmm. That social aspect comes from my high-functioning autism, which I had to learn how to deal with the social thing and internalizing the social cues of other people was something that was always going to be overwhelming for me.
Yeah. So, Andrew, remind us, when were you diagnosed with autism?
Not really until late primary school. Just before I went into year seven, we got the official diagnosis of autism.
It was actually the end of year seven, Andrew.
Yeah, it would have been. I thought I was doing the math in my head. But before that, I had been misdiagnosed with ADHD, mm-hmm. which wasn't really a misdiagnosis. It was just the, we looked at the brain, your brain's doing something weird, that's ADHD. That's what the method for diagnosing anything like that back then was. So I'd been on
Strattera,
which was a medication that was kind of new back then, which worked quite well for a while. But
you were one of the first couple of hundred kids in Australia who was actually on the medication.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't cheap either.
About $120 a month.
Yeah. So, but I was on that as a part of that. So the diagnosis for autism kind of snowballed after I finished on that medication because it no longer was really effective. And we went, okay, there's something else. And
the deal was that the moment the medication, Andrew actually would quite often refuse to take it. It was, Madison has memories of me chasing him around the house.
Take it.
So this was our morning routine. It was not that calm.
Yeah.
But our deal was, we said to Andrew, the moment you feel that this is not benefiting you, we will stop it. And it went from working very effectively and allowing Andrew's brain time to process what was going on. That really helped his decision-making skills, but then it brought out aggressiveness that is not Andrew at all. And it was at that point in time he said it's not working, and we said we don't think it's working, and we just stopped it. But Strattera, it almost falls into the class of antidepressants.
Yeah.
And for someone on autism, it probably worked very well.
Mm-hmm. It helped my anxiety dramatically.
Yeah, fantastic. So it must have been tricky for you as a family to be misdiagnosed, to be trying to cope with these, I guess, meltdowns, which, you know, the meltdown is a very general word. Like, that could be a behavioural issue. It could be oppositional, but for you it was more overwhelm, Andrew. Lisa, did you have family or friends around you who could, you know, be a support in those primary school years?
Well, no one in my family has actually had any diagnosis like this up until this point in time. Andrew was actually the first one diagnosed. He has cousins who are now diagnosed. And I remember when I first made it public with one side of my family, Darren was absolutely petrified what the reaction would be. And it was really amazing because one of my brother-in-laws looked at me and went, oh, that's normal. We've got kids as well. And so it was actually something that was quite supportive from that side of the family to be able to say, you're not alone. Other than that, I have a very beautiful friend in Sydney whose daughter is now 40, and she had an ADHD diagnosis back in the mid-80s. I've got to think about how long ago it is now. And other than that, we didn't really know anyone who was diagnosed. So her support and the fact that her daughter is now a highly successful psychologist, without her support, we'd have been totally lost.
Yeah.
And other than that, you know, people would assume that you were parenting badly, but it was not parenting. You couldn't just say, put Andrew to bed and he'd go to sleep. There was a whole process. And, you know, you were spoiling the child, you're pandering to them. But it was beyond that. Oh, just let him cry it out. No, a baby who cries and then throws up, that's normal. So I knew something was different from pretty much the moment Andrew was born. Mm-hmm. I knew it didn't affect his intelligence, but I knew we needed to have a different type of parenting approach than perhaps was used growing up.
Yeah. But you're saying it wasn't until primary school when you were getting these calls from the school that you thought perhaps there was the anxiety.
It was always suspicious that there was ADD or something going on, but it was a fight to get a diagnosis, get the doctor to believe you, oh, it's, you know, a mother who's paranoid. Got to the point where you're scared of going to the doctor because you don't want to be said that you've got Munchausen's by proxy.
Yep.
And it was such a relief eventually to get a referral to a paediatrician. It says, oh, you're not imagining this. the principal and the teachers wouldn't say something because our children were in a state school, and the Department of Education has a policy where you don't say to parents, oh, I think your child has got. And in the end, I said to the principal, for heaven's sake, I think that might be something along these lines. What do you think? Please tell me that I'm right and that I need to go and get something done. I don't know where to go to, but I need at least to be able to say the school agrees with me. And so eventually she said, oh, yes, I think something's going on. I went, thank heavens, finally. Even my family didn't want to say anything to me because they thought they'd offend me.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, for goodness sake, please tell me, because I think there's something wrong and I keep asking you and you won't say anything.
Yeah.
And that probably made me the angriest of all, was that people could see things and I'm looking for, am I imagining this? Because you're in such a, you are so focused on dealing with the problems that you can't look outwards, and someone coming and giving you some alternatives is really appreciated. At least from me it was.
Mm.
Yeah. So you went to the paediatrician. Who else helped on the ground, for example, Allied Health, to work with and to support you with the anxiety part of this?
The school counsellors helped.
Yeah.
Andrew, what do you think?
The school counsellor was great. Even though we're in a state system, she was an Adventist lady, which I'm a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. I grew up in a religious household. And so she was able to come at it from the spiritual perspective as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which was really helpful for me as a young child, because she understood my worldview. She understood all those sort of things. So she was able to give me a really good goal-oriented counselling, which you don't normally get from a school counsellor.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from that, our paediatrician, we actually saw him quite regularly. He was really good. And then...
He was from Sierra Leone, of all places, too.
Yeah, he was really good. And then we... were able to eventually get into OT, a bit more speech therapy, and eventually got to the educational psychologist as we moved through.
And you also had to see a sleep specialist as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Andrew doesn't have a sleep phase mechanism. It kind of works now he's an adult, but as a child he could go for probably 20 hours without sleep.
Yeah. So for you, it was a whole team approach, wasn't it? To help.
Eventually, yeah. It snowballed eventually. Having come from a regional town in Grafton where there was, as Mum would say, pretty much nothing, through to the Lake Macquarie region, where we were able to eventually pull a team around us. But it wasn't an overnight thing. It was a longitudinal, slow approach to find that and to work that out as we met people, as we got referred places, we'd see how that worked and eventually make a decision and find a team.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, can we talk a bit about, you know, from day to day, when you're in primary school or high school, what were the daily routines that were impacted the most with the anxiety, and what did that feel like in your family?
We had to make sure that Andrew had as few distractions as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And we, probably the biggest thing was, is I'm a no TV person and I've always been minimal TV. Whereas my husband grew up with the TV on, and he'd love the Today Show, you know, one of those early morning news shows. And it didn't really bother him getting ready because he worked from home. But it really, it was Andrew's, I've lost the word here, I want.
I got distracted.
He turned the TV on and Andrew was distracted. And it wasn't just that he was distracted for 5 minutes. He was gone for the whole morning. Couldn't eat his breakfast, couldn't get dressed. And eventually I convinced Darren that the TV had to go off. And after that, we had very few problems. But we were lucky because Andrew likes to get places early. And so once we got the TV off, he was into getting to school early for maximum playtime.
Well, more than that, even now, you probably get roll your eyes at this, Mum. But if the family's late, that was the worst thing for me. I would melt down because I needed to be places.
He still does.
On time, to the routine, even now. I start to get a little bit antsy if we're running late, even if it's a 2-hour drive ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up through high school and primary school, the biggest thing was to make sure that things were on time. I could have changes to the routine as long as it was communicated to me with the time.
Yep.
So for me, the timing of things is the biggest structure. So like yesterday I had a meeting and the person didn't turn up for the meeting at all. And that was like, oh, well, that's kind of, okay, what do I do now? So, yeah, and at high school, the social world kind of means that you don't have a routine.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You got your periods where you go to each class, but aside from that, the social world of high school means that you're going to be doing something different every single day. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a great thing, because you actually are forced to learn to be okay with things being different every single day and going with the flow.
Yeah. So did you try and create some structure for yourself within that lunchtime or before and after school?
Well, going through high school, you lose structure as you go through high school. That makes sense. Mm. You get free periods. You get time that you've got to direct yourself. You get half days where you go home at 11 o'clock or 1 o'clock. So in year 7 and 8, yes, you'd always go to the same crowd wrangle and play with the same people. But as you go through high school and as I went through high school, that changed to the point where structure kind of slowly went out the window.
Yeah. So did you try and create your own structure to cope with that change, or how did that work for you?
I guess by that point, I was self-managing everything, and it sounds really counterintuitive, but I had to learn to structure the unstructured. That meant that I would allow things to just be whatever they were. Mm-hmm. The bus is going to run late. There's no one left to hang out with. It's just me, or we're doing something at a different time. It was all that self-talk.
Yeah.
So you've got to learn how to self-talk to yourself and say, this is normal, this is what's going to happen, and I don't need to get upset by it.
Yeah.
Aside from that, for myself, if I was constantly demanding structure, you wouldn't be able to process everything that's going on. You've just got to allow things to flow. And teaching yourself how to do that is an important step, in my opinion, for people with high anxieties. To learn, okay, I've got to let this go. This is something I can't control. It's outside of my control. I don't need to get upset by it. I don't need to be anxious with it. We'll just move on.
And that's where Andrew's school counsellor was amazing. She was really good at giving Andrew the structure for that. What also happened was when we got his autism diagnosed when he was at the end of year 7, that gave him what's called a mental health confirmation sheet or a disability sheet in the state system. That back then entitled us to some tied funding, and it had to be spent on Andrew. What that gave him was a teacher's aid. He also had twins in his class who had autism as well, and they had quite a lot of tied funding. So there was an aide in the class who worked with Andrew to help him with organisation and structure and writing assignments down, the process of moving between classes. And Andrew didn't need that a lot, but what I think it did was it gave the support there in the background if he really needed it. And for us as a family, that was important. We actually had to fight quite a bit behind the scenes, make sure that Andrew got access to the learning support teacher. And again, she had an Adventist background, which was amazing. Her father was actually a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. And although she was in her 50s at the time, she knew what our family background was like. And she was an amazing support, not just to Andrew, but to Darren and I behind the scenes as well.
Mm.
And she gave me a lot of tips as a parent on how to manage. And she'd set up her routine so that she'd just bump into Andrew in the playground to have a quick checkup with him.
Mm.
And she helped a lot. Andrew has really good rule induction, so we didn't have to worry about behaviour, because once he learned what was required of him in the classroom and at school, he followed those rules.
So when I hear a rule, that's the law. Like, I can't go outside of that. What Mum was mentioning was that we, as a family, had to set things up so that we constantly had a set basis of rules that we would follow and that I would be able to feel comfortable with.
Yeah, so we were very, very, very good at having rules. And the thing is, for Andrew, as he got older, he's learned how to manipulate those rules so that he copes. So he's got a basic structure in his brain. And what I love is that every time Andrew reaches it or finds a new challenge, he then dissects it and he figures out how to cope with it. So some people with autism and anxiety, they can only cope with very narrow parameters. Andrew started off with those narrow parameters, but because of his natural intelligence and also because of how we've worked as a family, he's then learned how to integrate all those new challenges in so that he's got a basic pathway that he can follow. But then he can sit down and solve and deal with new challenges in his workplace. And we think that's really amazing.
That is a great skill. And I know that I've seen a few adults over the last couple of years who have, you know, been diagnosed in their mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
We know it. So it's some people, like, diagnosis is getting earlier and earlier, which is great for the early intervention. But there are still some people who, you know, who slip through the system until they're, you know, working adults, or they are struggling with their life skills as an adult, and then they're diagnosed. So it must be really hard for those who don't get that early intervention as a child.
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at me, I look at me and I go back in my head to when we lived in Western Australia, when we lived in Campsie. So I'm a 2 and a 4 year old. And then when we went to Papua New Guinea, I had huge amounts of anxiety, but there wasn't actually a label for it.
Mm.
And now I go, oh, my early experiences of anxiety have shaped who I am. And society didn't talk about it. There wasn't any support. And I think that mentally I'm healthier as an adult since I've realised what anxiety is and that I have it too. And then I look at my kids, I look at Andrew, I look at Madison, and I go, oh, my kids have got these strategies. You know, Lisa, I think you'd better take on board some of your kids' strategies, because what you are dealing with that's making you not cope is anxiety. And 12 months ago, I had an absolute and utter meltdown. I wouldn't call it a nervous breakdown, but I really, really crashed. Because I work full-time, but I work temporarily and casually. And so the anxiety of not knowing what work is going to be from one year to the other is really bad. And that's what caused me to crash at 12 months ago. This year, I had approached it with a totally different attitude. And mentally, I'm the healthiest I've ever been, I think, at the end of the school year. Because I actually looked, oh, my kids are dealing with anxiety. Hey, what you're experiencing is anxiety. I went and got some professional help, 3 sessions, and I've got skills that I know will benefit me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And, you know, I have talked to so many parents who have only realised in their early 40s that they have anxiety too. And you're right, like, sometimes it just takes, you know, 2 or 3 sessions with a psychologist or counsellor just to reframe and to learn about yourself, and to not to label yourself, but just to acknowledge, I guess, that this, you know, may be happening. And then you can, the overwhelm can sometimes go, or there's a reason for why you're feeling that way, and it can really change everything for you.
Anxiety is part of the human condition. It's not something that's bad. It doesn't make us defective. It's simply part of who we are. And I think having conversations like this, bringing out the bad and the ugly, actually helps people to say, hey, I'm normal. I'm not bad. I'm not defective. This is normal, and I just need some strategies to cope with it. And that actually reduces your anxiety by saying my feelings are valid.
Absolutely. Mm.
And to add to that, if you go back for me 12 months ago, pretty much almost to the day, Michaela, my wife and I, we were going through significant life changes in that we'd been married only for 6 months, and then we were moving to a completely new area and both starting brand new jobs. We've just graduated. So all those big life changes had happened at once. And anxiety, anyone's anxious in that time, let alone someone or two people who both have naturally high anxiety levels. And so I think that was a real test bed for my coping skills. How do you do it? How do you reframe? And having to go out and find a rental. That's a big thing as a young adult, to try and find your first proper rental. And yeah, it took a lot of effort mentally to be able to process and reframe and to make things work for us and work for me. It took constantly a lot of self-talk and a lot of calls to mum and dad and on both sides to actually settle in. And then we're like, are we going to make any friends? And all those sort of big questions you have, and you feel like a little kid again, if that makes sense. And for me, all the strategies that I've learned, which are just basic self-talk. Self-talk is king, and it worked, and I got through it. And it doesn't mean I wasn't anxious, but self-talk was the big way through it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think having these conversations more often about anxiety and how we cope individually is really important.
Absolutely. So we are running out of time. This has been really, really important, I think, for lots of families. Do you both have one point that you would like to finish up with about the importance of having a conversation about this within families and, I guess, just generally in the community?
It's really important to have the conversations, because by having the conversation, you can actually reduce the anxiety significantly. And I think it's important to say that because you have anxiety, it doesn't make you a bad person. You are still bright, you are still smart, you are still capable, but that's just simply something that happens. Anxiety is not bad. It's telling you that there is something that you need to address. And as I said, simply by having the conversation, it reduces the anxiety and it normalizes it.
Yeah.
For me, probably one point for me is self-talk. When we have the conversations, it kind of bounces off what my mum said, but we have the conversation and we're able to reframe our self-talk to be not necessarily positive, but to be realistic and to rationalize things. We are able to actually cope immediately in a much better and a much more healthy way. So self-talk would probably be my big thing.
Fantastic. Well, Andrew, might get you back on to talk about that self-talk, because you've talked about that a lot today. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing and being vulnerable, because I think we have strength of vulnerability and we need to have this conversation in the community a lot more, because there are so many people out there who are suffering from anxiety.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Thanks, Deb. I've really appreciated being here.
No worries. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Thank you for joining me on the Live Skills for Kids podcast, providing you with superstar parenting tips and empowering you to be the rock in your child's life. Do you have an anxious child and feel overwhelmed and unsure how to help them? Check out my book, Teaching Kids to Manage Anxiety, Superstar Practical Strategies, to help your anxious child move from fear and worry to confidence and peace. See you next time.